good evening, everyone. We're back once again. Welcome back to the second part of Navigate the Housing Bubble with Catherine Austin Fitz and with myself. I'm Byron Blitzos. I'm your host, and I'm the CEO and publisher of Origin Press. Well, Americans may soon wake up to discover that the international banking community is dictating to us that we are going to have to shift our own assets, even our personal assets, over to pay off our international creditors such as Japan or China, the Saudis. And this may be not unlike what we have already witnessed with the International Monetary Fund dictating terms to countries like Russia, Argentina, and many, many others. And with, just noticed today that Paul Wolfowitz was nominated to be the new president of the World Bank, and we can see from these indications where things are going. But with Catherine and the Solari opportunity, you can see that there's another way things could be going, and we'll be talking about that tonight. Tonight we're going to look at the situation we all face with falling income, increasing taxes, rising expenses. All these are things that are expected, and there are many critical issues we're going to deal with respect to the housing bubble and with respect to the macro, that is to say, the micro level. And a lot of these are going to come down in the form of wild cards, which Catherine's going to talk about tonight, among many other things. So tonight, in the second part of Navigate the Housing Bubble, we'll look at the micro level of how to deal with housing and all the things around that, and what you and I should be doing personally with our families and neighborhoods to prepare for the scenarios that Catherine's going to talk about in just a few moments, and which we'll pick up with after this introduction. In the meantime, please don't forget to send us your questions. And by the way, any and all feedback during the show or after the show, of course, send any of these feedback or questions to us at, as usual, at info@solari.com. Well, there's a lot to do tonight, so Catherine, let's, by way of review, why don't we start by looking at the scenarios that we're facing right now.
Okay. There are three scenarios that I always talk about as possibilities. One is slow burn, the first one, and slow burn is really the world that most of our communities are living in today, Byron, and have been really for the last 10 years. And that's an economy where you have a group of inside players who are living at greater than their productivity by subsidizing themselves, by draining everyone else. Now, many of us in the last 10 or 20 years have been the beneficiaries of the slow burn. We've been inside the bubble, but now more and more of us are falling out. And a slow burn is a process that has, for the last 10 years, been financed by borrowing more and more money, both consumers using our mortgages and credit cards, or the government. The governmental debt has ballooned fantastically, and that's been part of what's been helping to bubble our economy, along with all the mortgage financing. So a slow burn, if a slow burn continues, we continue to see more and more borrowing and more sort of draining of various groups to finance the inside players, but you don't get the second scenario, which is the Armageddon, which is a bust. You know, one of the Armageddon scenarios you hear people talk about is the Armageddon that could happen if the creditors pull the plug and stop financing the U.S. government. We're going through a process now where many communities are beginning to realize what's going to happen as the budget gets cut back. Now, all that assumes that the borrowing continues. You can imagine what would happen one day if suddenly the central banks did not show up and did not buy more treasury securities, and so the federal budget just couldn't proceed to cut all those food stamp checks or to cut all those government contract checks. So Armageddon could happen because we get a hiccup in the federal financing. Armageddon could happen because of peak oil. I mean, what happens if suddenly oil is just not there and prices skyrocket? So there are a series of different scenarios. The important thing to understand, Byron, is we could see both scenarios happening in the United States and in North America at the same time. So you literally, for example, I live in Hardeman County, Tennessee, And we are in a real slow-moving depression heading more towards Armageddon for many folks, whereas if you drive to New York or places where there are big government contracts, Washington in particular around the Beltway, you'll see much more of a slow burn scenario where insiders are doing fine and everyone else is getting drained.
So these are the two macro scenarios that we want to have as background as we talk tonight.
Right, and they're very different pictures for housing, because in a slow burn scenario, we could see a lot of the money that's been pulled out of the economy during the bubble and moved offshore as the dollar drops. We could see it come back in. In 1989, when I became Assistant Secretary of Housing, we had the last big burst of a housing and real estate bubble, and you saw housing prices drop dramatically. It was more, you know, it was not a 1929 scenario, but it was still a very significant burst. So you had a rise in unemployment, a huge drop in housing prices. That scenario could happen again, but in a slow burn. What could also happen is, as the dollar falls now, with significant more globalization than there was in 1989, you could see that money come back in. And buy housing, you know, sort of at 50 cents on the dollar from their point of view, but we wouldn't notice. Instead, the prices would go up. I always show folks a chart of the stock market. If you look at the Dow Jones in dollars, it looks like it's held steady or gone up a little bit. If you look at it in euros, it's dropped 30% over the last 6 months or so.
Oh, dear.
So a slow burn is a scenario where we are gentrified out of our homes because our expenses are rising, our income is going down, even though the price and value of our house is holding steady or rising. So we can't afford our own home. And Armageddon, you know, everything drops and all bets are off, particularly if it's a bad one. If you have not a 1989 recession but a depression, you're talking about a world where there's no civic capital and local self-sufficiency as there was in 1929, so it's a far more Orwellian scenario.
Now, the third scenario, of course, is the Solari scenario, and say a bit about that in this context.
Right. If we a slow burn and Armageddon are happening because we are consuming significantly more resources or consuming significantly more wealth than we're creating. If we reverse that and so locally start to dramatically increase productivity and decrease our debt, then we reverse the drain, you know, through what I call the drain of the tapeworm. And if we do it in an equity structure, then we start to create significantly new financial wealth that can offset the losses we're taking on the other side. So there is a way, but it requires very deep both, you know, cultural, political, and economic change to start to engineer to much more local productivity and use of resources.
As we have a lot of things to talk about tonight, so why don't we launch right into looking at the micro level of things, and in particular, earlier we were talking about what you call the middle class squeeze.
Right.
And I alluded to income taxes, expenses, those sorts of things. So why don't we run through that now?
Okay. It's the squeeze, it's very important for any of the listeners who are trying to figure out what do I do? Do I buy? Do I sell? Do I move? It's very important to look at the different economics of owning and managing the home or your apartment, whether you own or you rent, to see how these different, the macroeconomics that we talked about last week, Byron, how they are going to play out in terms of your particular financial situation. The first thing I always look at is revenues, because what we are facing now is a significant drop in employment income. Both if I have a job, or if I have a small business. And that's because we've made an effort over the last 10 years to move significant amounts of the high-paying jobs abroad and bring in immigration to take other significant high-paying jobs. So we're looking at a situation where significant employment has been outsourced, and will continue, and corporations will continue to consolidate and shut down employment and work here. And Americans will have to compete in a much more competitive situation for employment and work. In addition, we've had 10 years where the cost of capital between large corporations and small businesses, which is at the heart of the Saleri model, those chickens are coming home to roost, and so small business income has dropped. Small business bankruptcies and failures are significant. I'm up in Montana tonight talking from Montana, and it's the same here as in my hometown of Hickory Valley, Tennessee, which is we've had a lot of farmers holding on to their land, but we've reached a critical point where without competitive equity financing to bank that land, you could see a lot of those small farms disappear. So small business has been struggling with this huge and growing cost of capital handicap, and unless that's addressed, you're going to see small businesses closing. And so Americans generally are looking at a big drop in revenues. Now, in addition, a lot of Americans have been depending on capital gains from selling their house or just as prices go up, financing their homes to finance this deficit. I think I talked last week in the teleseminar that Northern Trust did a study and showed American households had a $342 billion household deficit last year. Well, the way a lot of us have been financing that deficit is by borrowing more money through our homes. If the bubble bursts and housing prices drop, that vehicle is not going to be available. There won't be as much liquidity in the markets. Our homes won't be worth more than what we've already pulled out or what our mortgage is. And so that source of revenues is going to continue to be squeezed. Finally, if the bubble bursts, then a lot of things that have been holding up the stock market as well, so other investment income is not going to be available. So we're looking at a revenue picture, which for most people is revenues are steady or falling.
Right.
And that means even if I have a great job and my income's okay, there's going to be other people in my family, my friends, those around me who are going to be suffering, and I'm going to feel the blowback of that income dropping as well.
What about the other elements of the tax?
Well, the big one is taxes, which is we have a federal government that, as an economic matter, is essentially bankrupt. We know in 2004 they wrote up their liabilities $11 trillion. What does that mean in terms of the creditors refusing to roll over or simply to ask for more money from us in taxes? I mean, we've seen international groups dictate terms of, you know, more taxes in situations like that. So that's one of the wild cards. The more predictable one, Byron, is that state and local governments are going to feel the squeeze as the economy slows down or the bubble bursts. That means state and local governments are going to come under pressure. And what we're seeing across the country is a move to privatize essential assets, basically sell or auction off water, utilities, land to private investors. Now, this is a process that we've seen in other countries do terrible things to people's financial securities. If I auction off my local water, my local utility, after I sell it to the private investors, a year or two down the pike, they can jack up rates tremendously, and this is what we've seen around the world. So one of the opportunities we're going to talk about later is organizing and inserting yourself in that process to make sure that that doesn't happen. The reason it's going to happen is state and local governments are going to say to folks, look, you know, we need to raise revenues, therefore it's privatize or raise your taxes. And so just as our revenues are dropping, we're going to have government coming back and saying we need more money. We need to raise your taxes. We've seen in many places property taxes around the country start to edge up over the last couple of years.
What about other kinds of expenses aside from taxes, Catherine?
Well, the expense equation is the one that worries me the most, and that's because anybody I know right before I left Tennessee, the price of a regular gallon of gas at the farm co-op was $2.07 and rising. That has a devastating impact to any community like mine. But what we're seeing is, and this is the whole issue of peak oil and the continued suppression of alternative energy, we're seeing gas and heating prices rise. And that doesn't just hit you, Byron, in how you heat your home. It hits you in all the things you need to buy and maintain your home. It's a cross-cutting expense that could run the price of just about everything up. And it can certainly hit hard because particularly in the 90s, many of the homes that were built were large, depended on cheap fossil fuel to heat them, and they were laid out in land and housing patterns that meant we all had to drive a long way to work. So whether it was the heating the home or driving to and from employment, you know, the economics of those homes was based on cheap fossil fuels, and that's no longer the case, which means whether it's driving to or from work in our home or heating it, we're looking at very, very significant increases in energy prices.
What about other things like food, healthcare, interest rates?
Right. Another important thing to watch, particularly in an Armageddon scenario, is we'd had the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, say in Frankfurter about 3 months ago, anybody who doesn't anticipate higher interest rates in the U.S. clearly wants to lose money. So we've had plenty of warnings, and both in a slow burn and Armageddon, we could go through a period of rising interest rates or even very significant rising interest rates if there's a credit crunch and liquidity crunch. For anybody who's got a variable rate mortgage, that could be a real problem. For anybody who needs to sell their house, that's a real problem because the cost of people, you know, the cost of financing that home is going to rise dramatically if that should happen, which means your value is impacted significantly. So interest rates are one of the big wild cards. Another one, one that happened personally to me, I just had my home insurance go up by a multiple of five. And this ties into another risk, which is environmental deterioration. But I'm in an area with lots of tornadoes and where there's been a lot of insurance expenses in the last couple of years, Byron. But we're watching insurance prices go up, home property, others around the country. So we're looking at a squeeze, which is lower revenues, higher expenses, in an environment where the value of our equity is dropping and taxes could rise or be a wild card. So it's not a pretty picture, even in the best of circumstances, unless you are in one of those places where the tapeworm is, you know, hoarding cash. You know, if you're inside the Beltway and you've got big government contracts, so be it. But outside of the war economy, it's a real squeeze.
Well, let's say a bit more about these wild cards, Catherine.
Sure. We talked about interest rates and unemployment. Energy prices is a big one. Immigration is a big one that can have a dramatic, you know, essentially, Byron, my read on things is the borders are open. And what we've seen is significant immigration in various places have a tremendous impact, sometimes, you know, supporting the housing market, sometimes simply, you know, taking employment away and squeezing people. So it very much depends on what area you're in. But I think it's fair to say that we're going to continue to see a dramatic flow of immigrants from places, you know, where people are used to living on much lower incomes. And that could really change the economy and the politics of where you are. And it really it's very spotty as to where you are. But I think that's going to be another thing that the thing that worries me the most for most situations, most of the kind of people who would be on this call, is what are the politics going to be of the $10 trillion that's been pulled out of this country, $4 trillion out of our government, and is that money going to come back in as we saw it do in 1989 and literally come into our communities on the pretext of privatization and buy our essential assets out from under us? And that's one of my greatest concerns because the politics of what gets done with that investment and how is going to be critical to sort of the governance of our future. And it's a very big wild card. I mean, needless to say, $10 trillion is a lot of money.
Isn't it pretty much guaranteed that that money is going to come back in as all of these factors that you've just identified, aren't they going to make it a pretty attractive market for those folks to come back in and buy things up?
Right, but they could come back in on an Armageddon scenario, which is more like a 1989. I mean, they really busted the markets and came back and bought 10 cents on the dollar. This time, because of globalization, Byron, they cannot bust the market and simply, you know, in a much more sneaky way, buy up slowly in a slow burn. In fact, it's interesting, when I speak in workshops, most people are more concerned about the Armageddon scenario. I prefer the Armageddon scenario because in the Armageddon scenario, the productive, you know, who's productive and how productive they are matters again. Whereas in the slow burn scenario, what matters is, are you an insider or an outsider? And so if someone is chosen to compete based on performance rather than being going along with a tapeworm, productive people, I think, have a better chance in an Armageddon. In a slow burn, I think most people have zero chance. It's just a matter of when the tapeworm comes and drains you. So now there are exceptions to every rule, but the strategy of working harder, being more careful, being conservative, being smart, you know, at some point that doesn't work when we're paying a third of our money into a tax system and that money is then being used to drain us increasingly in fraudulent ways. That's a hamster on a wheel, and it's a very negative situation. It's a long-term squeeze, and ultimately that's what's wiping out the middle class.
Well, this is a fairly harsh look at things and nakedly looking at this, and I think that's what we're trying to do in these teleseminars is provide these facts unvarnished. And perhaps we should, unless you want to summarize on any of that, Catherine.
Let's talk about strategies, because the strategy that's worked, I know so many people, and I know you do too, Barton, who have stretched and stretched to buy a large home, a larger than their needs, and that strategy has been successful. They've generated significant capital gains. They've increased their wealth tremendously. And, you know, that those kinds of strategies have worked over the last 10 years, but they may not work in the future. So it's really important to think in a slow burner, an Armageddon, what is the smart strategy for me and my family? Because let's remember, some of our listeners have not been able to buy a home. You know, the prices got away from them during the bubble. And so, you know, if it's a 1989 scenario, in 1989 there were a lot of folks who picked up real estate at very low prices and so bought their family home for 10 cents on the dollar. One thing that most Americans should consider doing, Byron, is to downsize their home. We have all, with cheap fossil fuel, gotten into the habit of having enormous amounts of space that we really don't need. And so, you know, before 1996, I lived I had a mansion in Washington and two full-time people taking care of it. You know, I now live in an 800-square-foot house in Tennessee, and I've downsized, and I know, God bless eBay. One of the things I say to everybody is, while you can, go around, you know, whatever you have in your house that you don't need, for goodness sakes, you know, make that your Christmas or birthday present, or, you know, get onto eBay and get it sold, or do a yard sale or a car sale. But there's tremendous benefit to simplifying, and I would really encourage that now. Depending on your situation, if you own your home and you have a lot of equity in your home, now is the time, if you don't want to move, to consider whether or not you should cash some of that equity out and put it elsewhere, particularly if you're in a place where you don't have a lot of food and water and energy self-sufficiency. If you don't want to make those investments to get there, having some money as a backup. Now, that usually I tell people, Byron, to pay down, it's better to pay down your debt. But if you've got a big chunk of your equity in your home, there's nothing like having liquidity in reserves, and so this is a time to consider doing that. I know one of the things I think a lot about is how to reduce overhead, because this is an environment where you want to have as low expenses as you possibly can. So another possible strategy for folks is whether it's now buying a place which is more energy self-sufficient or requires less energy, or making those investments, taking the time to learn about different things you can do, from insulation to partial energy solutions. I know some people live in places where wind and other partial solutions make sense. But any investments of your time and resources that you can do to permanently lower the maintenance costs of your housing, this is the time to start learning about it and doing it. I know that some people are in a position to consider co-housing or taking in boarders. So maybe I don't want to downsize the size of my home, but I can certainly downsize the space I use by you know, turning the house into something that houses more people than it does now. So there are a lot of creative solutions, the least of which is, you know, is moving. In 1998, when I realized I was sitting in the middle of Washington about 10 blocks from the White House, I said, you know, now is the time to move to a farming community in and with and near the people I love and family, particularly family who are much more interested in helping and being part of a community. So I really decided to get out of a place where there was very little community and get to a place where there was community. So one decision you can make and one strategy is just to move.
That wrap up one of the things we should be thinking about with regard to our homes?
Well, the one thing I would say, because I'm an investment banker, so I have to say this, for people who are financially sophisticated and interested in finance, if you're really concerned about a housing bubble, there are a whole series of trading strategies that you can do to make money if the bubble bursts. So as one mutual friend said to me the other day, if you think the bubble's going to burst, then write some puts against Fannie Mae. So certainly if somebody is interested in the financial markets and has the time to do it, if you're concerned that your house is going to drop in value or any of these things are going to happen, there are ways to hedge your bets. And that's a whole different conversation. But for any drop in a market, there is a way to use financial strategies to hedge your bets. So those exist. I know I don't think people with a huge heating bill are going to go out and buy, you know, oil futures, but obviously a neighborhood could do that. You know, there are trading strategies to protect your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some of the strategies not having to do with our properties and our homes. What would they be?
Well, there are a whole series of things that you can do to either, you know, sort of clean the tapeworm out of your life. We had a teleseminar, Byron, on coming clean. And so all those things are related to sort of your health, your energy, and your overall revenues and expenses. So all of those strategies work. A lot of the biggest strategies are getting involved in your community, finding out who your neighbors are, what the resources in your neighborhood are, finding out what the financial issues are. You know, is the water going to be privatized here? Is it going to be the land? Are the utilities running up in price? To the extent that people have the time and the inclination, starting to learn about how the municipal and state money in your place work, who's running for office, who's in the different positions, and how you can get involved to protect the value of your property and to protect the strategic assets in your neighborhood in a way that protect you and your family is always a good investment of time if you go about it with a mindset of, you know, realizing that trying to protect yourself simply through your own, you know, that which is under your control, there's a lot you can do, but there are boundaries. Ultimately, the drain is coming at you through municipal, state, and federal government in your place. And so starting to organize to deal with that is a real opportunity. What I stress, because you can certainly waste a huge amount of time trying to do that. The reason Solari stresses doing it in a way that makes you money is that's the way to approach it, where your efforts and the efforts of the people who help you is really sustainable.
Anything else in this category?
Oh, you know, I could talk forever, but
sure.
I always say there are diamonds in your own backyard.
Yes.
There are significant human and financial diamonds in your backyard. Having a housing bubble, Byron, has enabled us to not have to look at or face what's going on in our own backyard. And so the day is coming when we have no choice but to face it. But what I promise everybody is if you get under the carpet and start looking at what the roaches are doing, you will find that there are diamonds in your own backyard. You just got to get them back from the tapeworm.
Well, I think everybody on this call is going to be clever and wise in looking at these things. But earlier we were talking about traps that people really the tapeworm traps, you might say, that are laid for us. And let's take a minute and look at what some of those might be.
Yeah, there are a couple traps, and my guess is that these are traps that some of the people who are listening tonight will run into, but certainly not everyone. And every circumstance is different, but I just want to mention them because if you know they're coming and they happen to be something that might impact you, then knowing is having the ability to duck them. In 1989, Byron, when I became Assistant Secretary of Housing, what I watched was as we started to clean up some very significant Iran-Contra and S&L fraud, a real effort was made by the enforcement groups at the Department of Justice and HUD and other sort of real estate-related enforcement groups to scapegoat the little guy. So to pick out people in the home building, the mortgage banking and appraisal industry, both, you know, sole proprietors, individuals, companies, and really scapegoat them in the press and make them out to be the scapegoat for what, you know, the poster child of all this scandal. And so there was a lot of targeting and prosecuting of the innocent to try and create some air cover for all the fraud that had gone on.
Right.
So while the people who had stolen $500 billion were busy buying everything at 10 cents on the dollar, you know, the FBI and Jack Kemp were running around and screaming about, you know, Robin Hood and all these sort of scandals that involved very little money and in some cases put what I believe to be innocent people away for a couple of years. It was a diversion. It was a distraction. At the same time, if you're in the home building or mortgage banking or appraisal or any of the industries affected, you know, the resulting laws resulted in far more centralization and far more centralized control of those industries. So you know, it's both a diversion and a way of creating more laws and more controls, but certainly you don't want to be the scapegoat. And so if you're in any of these related industries and you start to hear more and more of, you know, this, you know, it's an activity to duck, it's an activity to avoid, and please don't think that it's necessarily sincere when the Department of Justice shows up and says they're trying to stop fraud in your industry. There's also, we've seen patterns and lots of reports of increasing servicing fraud by mortgage servicers. So let's say you and I have a mortgage, and the servicer or the pool that the mortgage is in starts to get into financial trouble, and they're looking for money, and they start to do a series of billing practices or taking money from escrows that impact sort of, you know, cost us money or, Byron, even default us on the mortgage when we shouldn't be in default. So this is a time when it pays to have your mortgage owned by, you know, a local community bank you trust or to have perfect records and to really watch to make sure that there are no predatory practices involved in the financial arrangements you use. We're also, my prediction is, because there has been so much fraudulent inducement of mortgages, my prediction is you're going to see fraudsters use things like that, which could be used legitimately to perpetrate new frauds. So my guess is we're going to see the kind of wave of frauds that you see in a market dump as opposed to a market pump. Another thing is for those of us who have to face or go through foreclosures, the laws are different in different states and the practice is different in different locales. This is a time to make sure if you do lose a home to foreclosure that you continue to watch the process afterwards because you don't want to get stuck with a deficiency judgment that is far more than it should be. I used to watch at HUD when a mortgage would default, a house was foreclosed on and then transferred or sold at really below market prices in a situation where, in theory, the initial borrower could have gotten stuck as owing much more money than they really should have. So this is the time when, even when you get foreclosed on, you want to make sure you keep watching the process. There are bankruptcy reforms in Congress. It's possible that we could see more on the way that give Byron significant rights to creditors. You know, my biggest fear over the last 10 years as these laws continue to change is that we're literally evolving back to a world where, you know, prisoners debtor's prison is, you know, we're getting closer and closer to debtor's prison. So this is a time when you want to have as little debt as possible, again, unless you're in a position to cash money out, pull money out, and protect yourself in that eventuality. The last tapeworm trap that everybody needs to be warned about is many of our mortgages during the bubble, particularly the new mortgages originated between 96 and now that are still outstanding, Byron, have been pooled and sold to our pension funds. And so it's really a double whammy. If I lose my job and I then default on my mortgage and lose my home, then the other loser is going to be my retirement savings.
How does that work?
So, well, because we have pooled together these mortgages and sold them to our pension funds. And so we know we've had reports of the Pension Benefit Corporation, which guarantees corporate pension funds, indicating that it's bankrupt and it can't cover all the liabilities. So we've had lots of rumors and indications that the pension funds are in real trouble. An Armageddon scenario means the pension funds could be our pension funds, people who think that they are due to get governmental and corporate pension funds could see those benefits diminished or even lost, particularly if it's combined with real problems with the federal credit, which guarantees or backs so much of it. So we're looking at a situation where not only does the value of our home drop, but the value of our pension funds drop at the same time. So it's a double whammy.
We're not going to talk about Social Security tonight, are we?
Well,
well,
but Social Security is a very important part of this, because right now the single biggest cause of this squeeze that we are all experiencing, whether it's on our home or any other part of our financial picture, Byron, is coming from certain players having a cheap cost of capital and us having a very expensive cost of capital. So if my small business needs to finance, it's got to borrow at the bank at a high rate, whereas the company coming in to take over my market share is basically financing almost for free with my pension fund. Now, that differential creates a rigged deal where the tapeworm can always beat me, you know, unless I work 50 times harder and am really lucky. Now, if you think that's bad right now, wait till you see what happens when they can do it overtly with Social Security. Because no matter which part of the reform, you know, package you want to present, it's going to make it much cheaper for the tapeworm companies and the large companies to finance versus us. So we're taking the last part of our pension fund and retirement savings and basically, you know, again lowering the tapeworm's cost of capital up against ourselves. So nothing could move us further away from self-sufficiency than tapeworm, than Social Security privatization. So, in fact, it does fit in. It is another tapeworm trap.
Well, folks, we're going to be building ourselves up to some solutions and some opportunities. I know we seem to be at a low point in terms of the difficulties that we face, but Catherine, we wanted to, you and I were going to go through some case studies here.
Right, and we have the case studies up on the event resources page, and I found it helps people to understand some of the opportunities in terms of looking at the different families. One, we use two families, Byron. And I would encourage anybody who's online to go take a look at the Housing Bubble Event Resource page and click and take a look at the two fact sheets. One is Bill and Alice, who are a couple who live, we have been living in Sonoma County. They have three grown kids. They have a house valued at $650,000 with a variable rate mortgage of $250,000 and $20,000 of auto debt. And they have an IRA of $550,000 and $200,000 of savings at Morgan Stanley. Now, this is a couple who should seriously consider either paying down their mortgage or moving their mortgage to a fixed rate.
Why do you say that?
Well, they've got a $250,000 variable rate mortgage, and if you're going into a scenario where interest rates could rise, that could put them at a significant disadvantage. Now, if they have an opportunity to just buy a ceiling for that variable rate mortgage, that's another thing they can do. But this is an environment where they probably don't want to run more interest rate risk. They've been doing that now and getting a really probably a much cheaper rate on their mortgage. but now's the time to think about paying that down. Or the other thing they could do, Byron, is set aside the money that they don't pay if they've done a fixed rate and just put it in reserve to handle an increase in that variable rate price. That's one thing they could do. Another thing is their son, Dave, is an environmentalist who focuses on renewable energy and self-sufficiency. They have $200,000 sitting at Morgan Stanley in tax-exempt bonds and securities. This is a perfect time for them to reconsider whether or not they want to invest in local energy self-sufficiency, water, food, depending, you know, in their neighborhood. In Sonoma County, that would be, that's a very sensible thing to start to look into, particularly because they have the knowledge that they need in the family. Bill's an accountant. He's got another son, Joey, who's a tax accountant. So here we have a family who has a significant amount of resources that they can use to start to re-engineer how they do things to protect themselves. Our second case study, which is Frank and Angie, this is not Sonoma County. This is La Cruz, New Mexico. And they've just taken out a second mortgage on their home to bail one of their kids out of jail.
Right.
And they have very high credit card debt, I think 12%. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, how can they get out of debt? And this is one situation where there's a real attraction to trying to refinance that credit card debt out or to sell the house if need be and downsize even further. But that 12% credit card debt is a real overhang. And so what they do on their home very much relates to what they have to do to, now is the time to get out of debt. Now, Frank has a job at the local gas company, and that's probably a relatively secure job. But this is a family in real trouble, and one of the things you see is in many communities you'll have a Bill and an Alice and you'll have a Frank and Angie. And, in fact, they're both the solutions to each other's problems because there's a way for a Bill and Alice to finance Frank and Angie out of their credit card debt, which is a much better investment for Bill and Angie than keeping their money at Morgan Stanley in sort of tapeworm stocks.
For Bill and Alice, yes.
Right. And they both, what they're both going to need is they're going to both need significantly more energy, food, and water self-sufficiency. What they both, one of their biggest opportunities is to do a Solari model privatization instead of letting the tapeworm come in and grab these assets in a corporate privatization. But that's only going to happen if Frank and Angie and Bill and Alice realize that there is a model where they both can solve their problems in a way that, frankly, generates a very attractive return to Bill and Alice. So if we can get the folks with investment capital in a community to see the opportunity of banking local self-sufficiency for everybody, but it's got to be a model that respects the importance of generating an attractive return to the people with investment capital, and traditionally we haven't seen that. In most communities, the Frank and Angie's and the young people do not organize into a model that respects Bill and Alice's investment capital. And so if we can do that, and that's what the Solari model is, then we can start to also attract capital from outside the community in a model that backs us instead of the tapeworm.
You folks out there who are sending us questions, I would expect that some of you will talk about your particular case. And if you do so, try to wrap it around some of the facts of your situation. And keep in mind that we can't address too much of that because everybody's very special and very individual. However, we look forward to seeing your questions in about 20 minutes from now. Catherine, anything more on these case studies?
No, I think what we should do is talk through where the opportunities are going to be in the different scenarios.
All right, let's go into that. I'd love to hear about opportunities after all this tonight. And how about if we run through both slow burn and Armageddon in that respect in each case?
In both scenarios, Byron, the guy who's going to do well is the guy who's prepared.
Yes.
And if you have the stomach to sort of understand the tapeworm and see how the tapeworm operates in your community, which I have to tell you, it takes a lot of stomach, but if you can do it, then you can start to see where the opportunities. In an Armageddon, prices drop a lot. And I have to tell you, in 1989, the people who had anticipated the drop and had created liquidity They made a fantastic amount of money. So in an Armageddon scenario, if you've anticipated the drop and have established the liquidity to deal with it, particularly if you have ways of dealing with the different self-sufficiency issues. Because, of course, the problem here is not just that say, the expenses of heating goes up, but that heating is just not available. So there's not just an issue of what is the price of some of food and heat and water and shelter. It's going to be what is the availability of some of these things if we get, you know, problems on the grid, et cetera. So people who have really prepared and organized both operationally and financially are going to be in the catbird seat. And so in an Armageddon, it's really can you establish liquidity and take advantage of the drop in prices and the importance of people establishing self-sufficiency. A slow burn is going to be a little bit different because here, you know, you're going to want to be in a model where you are buying and managing real estate with other people's money because you don't want to be risk of things turning to an Armageddon. And so you're much more working in the tapeworm model. This is kind of the, you know, having been the Federal Housing Commissioner, Byron, I've seen generation after generation of people take government financing and contracts and, you know, buy real estate with no money down and no risks. There's still many ways to do it, but in a slow burn scenario where the tapeworm controls, it's one of the safest ways to invest in real estate. Even in a slow burn, the move to self-sufficiency is there, and the opportunities in the Solari models are there. They just happen in a slower, more careful way. Now, in both scenarios, there are definitely strategies called follow the tapeworm that work. They're not things I like to promote, but they do. We've seen as the tapeworm goes to Russia, goes to Latin America, and sort of busts the economy. The IMF comes in and busts the economy in economic warfare. You'll see the newsletters come out to invite lots of investors to come in and follow the tapeworm and sort of be the first wave of financing that generates the first capital gains for the tapeworm who's in early. So there's no doubt there's a follow the tapeworm strategy that is of no interest to me because I think our situation is far more dire than that. I mean, I think our situation is really to a point where if we don't start to do the Solari solution or something like it, we're facing a significant deterioration in not just our finances but our culture. So, you know, for our current situation, Byron, is we are spending far greater than our productivity. So real economic opportunity comes not from, you know, following somebody around and hugging them close in the game of musical chairs, but looking at where is the fundamental need to really increase productivity, where is that opportunity, and to make that happen.
Aren't we also saying, Catherine, that yes, the tapeworm may have certain returns on investment if you follow it, but really over the long term, Solari is a far higher return on your investment, both time.
Well, but what's the point of sitting in your home rich if all your family has been tapewormed out of existence?
Right.
That's no fun, Byron. So
even if you're so narrow as to just think about money, I mean, you're still going to be making a great deal of money if you engineer Solari in your neighborhood.
Right.
And over time, the profit margins are going to be higher.
Well, the other case study I wanted to use tonight was Catherine, because in 1998 I was sitting, you know, I used to be a very wealthy person, and I was. I've got to put the pictures up on the Internet. I was sitting in a very beautiful mansion in Washington, D.C. I had a household staff of two people just to take care of the house. And it was the life of Riley. In fact, the house got purchased by Oprah Winfrey's decorator.
Oh, really?
You know, when I sold it. But what I realized was, look, if they're stealing $4 trillion out of the U.S. government, I'm not going to own my house either way. You know, it doesn't matter. If we're going to fraudulently induce a couple $1 trillion of mortgages, the country's going down the chute. So, you know, I kind of felt, given what I understood about the economics, that there was no point in trying to own assets because this was a situation where your assets wouldn't end up being yours. I mean, that's how bad the political and financial deterioration was. And I also felt that the follow the tapeworm scenario, Byron, meant that I would basically be, you know, I would continue to be a wealthy person by helping support a machinery that was basically going to wipe out my family and friends, or most of them. And so my bet, you know, I sold everything, and including selling massive amounts of furniture and possessions through eBay, and I used that to bank essentially, you know, Solari and everything we're doing, including tonight, you know, this teleseminar. So, yeah, I'm not saying to everybody, you know, sell everything and bet the ranch that, that you can, you know, support planetary transformation. But I was, in fact, very lucky because what I understood was the tapeworm through the federal credit and the Treasury was liquidating the value of my house anyway. So I might as well get the money out and try and do something about it.
Well, we're getting on to a more positive note here, aren't we?
Well, I think it was an excellent investment because I think the value of that mansion is... I would not want to be sitting in Washington with a, you know, a $2 million house and a $600,000 mortgage, Byron. No, no.
Well, here we
are. I'd have to get a job with Halliburton.
Pretty soon you'd be living behind walls.
Or deserve to be.
You know, right. Well, Catherine, how are we going to, you know, get to you know, the right demeanor that people should have, the bottom line?
Here's my bottom line, because I like to bring things down to it. The net is I'm a pretty conservative person. I would not want more than 25% of my financial equity tied up in a primary home unless it was fairly self-sufficient, which means, you know, my community had reasonable food, water, and energy self-sufficiency. I had a low overhead. I had low maintenance. I was with the people I wanted to share my life with in a place I wanted to share my life. And there was neighbors and municipality. You know, I felt I could trust reasonably in either one of Slow Burn or Armageddon. So I would have no problem sort of betting my, taking all my financial assets and getting to a place that fit that description. I would not want to tie up a lot of my equity in a primary home that didn't fit those. You know, I would not want to tie up a lot of my, I mean, that was the problem in Washington. I had a big piece of my equity in a home that was in a scenario that I didn't think was, or in a place that I didn't want to be in, either a Slow Burn or an Armageddon. So I think the key thing is diversity. I'm a great believer in diversification of financial assets. The most important thing, and this is how I ended last week, and I'm going to say the same thing again, Byron, the most important question that will drive what you do in terms of whether you own or whether you rent and where you live is, who do you want to share your life with? And who do you want to share your life with if we should go into, you know, a bad Slow Burn or an Armageddon? So I think that's the question, and what you do and all the financial decisions in and around that really revolve around, you know, who you can be with that will make your life pleasant and safe in a tough case. But this is not a lot of, you know, do not have a lot of equity at stake in something that has a very high overhead and where you are very dependent on central systems. What you're doing is you are making yourself incredibly dependent on the war machine, and unless you're going to rise to the top of Halliburton, that's a real financial problem.
Catherine, can you wrap up on this discussion of the bottom line with reference to Armageddon versus Slow Burn and what variables that we should, you know, come out of this and keep in mind as we get into the Q&A?
I think you need to pay down your debt. I think you need to be liquid. I don't think you want a lot of money in your home unless you're moving to self-sufficiency. If you live in an area where you don't think that's a good place to be during a probable scenario, then I think it's time to start exploring a backup. But the housing bubble is either going to burst, Byron, or if it doesn't burst, we're going to be in a slow burn that could be worse for most of the listeners on this call. So unfortunately or fortunately, I think there's no way out of our situation in a slow burn or an Armageddon unless you start to organize to find solutions that are greater than just you and your family. And that's why we created the Solari model, was to help people, you know, provide a toolkit to help start to organize in sustainable ways. But most of the solutions are outside of our individual financial statements and balance sheet and outside of our individual home. They all come down to community.
So organizing community, either way, Armageddon or not, is there's no difference really when it comes down to the bottom line. We need to get together and help each other be secure financially.
Right. We need to reverse the drain in our own lives, and then we need to organize with others to keep reversing the drain on a wider basis.
In this connection, once again, I want to invite everybody to go back. If you haven't listened to the Coming Clean teleseminar, it's, I think, an essential tie-in to what we've done tonight. Catherine, is there anything else you want to do by way of summing up before we get to Q&A?
No, let's go to Q&A, Byron.
All right, let's look at the questions that have come in. So here we go. Wow, here we go. Here's somebody asking you to get closer to the mic on the telephone. So just
get closer to the mic. I'm closer.
Okay, there we go. We've got, it says here in part one of last week, at the end, Catherine, you seem to be implying we should consider moving out of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
What other countries do you consider safe?
There is, from the Wilderness, posted a chart of the companies that do not have extradition related to the draft. I think for most families that might consider leaving the country, one of the driving issues is going to be moving their children or people in their family away from the draft. So the From the Wilderness is one. I think there are five countries that don't have extradition. So that is one issue. I think the critical issue, I think the thing that makes a person safe is community. So a lot of where you might move to relates to where do you have family and friends, where do you have relationships, where can you come in and be a real part of the community. So community would be number one. I've traveled around the world trying to determine if I was to leave the United States where I'd like to go. Probably my favorite country is New Zealand. I'm a great lover of New Zealand, and at the worst part, Byron, of my legal problems with the Department of Justice, I used to go to the New Zealand website and sort of pine at the thought of leaving. But I have come to the conclusion, for me personally, and I think it's a very personal decision, I have no interest in leaving the United States. I kind of feel that my family's been running away from the tapeworm for about 500 years, and so the time has come for the Fitzwillets family to turn and face and deal with the tapeworm.
Okay.
So I think there are a lot of places to move to if you're interested, but the important criteria is where do you have community, where are you known, where are there people who care about you?
I think that's the spirit and the upshot of everything you're talking about, Catherine, is, you know, is find the place where you can build and organize and be with the people you love rather than leave the country. Well, we have
right. Although I will say, for some people, moving to a country where the costs are much lower. I have many friends who have family in other countries where the overhead is much lower, and they can cash out their equity in a home, go to that place, and be with family and friends in a wonderful and warm and beautiful community. And so, for some families, that's an intelligent strategy.
Okay.
I think it's really what's in your heart.
Yes, good. Here's a middle-aged couple. They say here, we've moved to a more affordable area so we could buy our own home. Now we're looking to buy the prices that are skyrocketing. They're looking to buy the prices that are skyrocketing. Not sure how they mean that. We feel very pressured to buy something before we are priced out altogether. It doesn't feel safe to just wait for the bubble to burst and for prices to drop. Your thoughts. Thank you.
Right. And that's, Byron, that's an excellent question, and that's the most difficult question to know the right answer, because generally anybody who's bet the ranch that the Armageddon scenario was going to come true has been wrong and has gotten priced out. And generally people who have assumed it was going to be a slow burn and bought in have been okay. So I I can't give a perfect answer because I don't know which is going to happen. My guess is the next year or two we're going to continue to be in a slow burn, and it is possible we could be in a slow burn the whole way. It really comes down to how much equity is going to be put into the home and how, to what extent that home is going to be dependent. Me personally, I would feel very uncomfortable betting the ranch that home prices were going to stay the same and rise if it was a significant amount of my equity. But that's me personally. But I would not feel comfortable in this environment having a significant portion of my equity in a U.S. home.
Catherine, you and I were talking about earlier with regard to some wild cards. There's a lot of people that I know, and even myself, that, well, there's going to be this Armageddon. There's going to be some huge political event or terrorist event or war or something like that. And I'm going, you know, it's implied in this question, too. I'm going to wait and see. That's going to tell me what to do. It's going to, you know, we can respond to one of these big wild card planetary events, a negative event, after that happens and anticipate that. And I think earlier you were saying that there's no liberation that comes from some sort of political spike of that kind. It only makes things worse for us.
Right. I think that there is a significant chance. I was very worried about an Armageddon scenario in 2005 after the election, only because I watched the bubble burst in 1989 in a way that was planned. I mean, I believe in 1989 it was an intentional burst. So I was worried that the same thing would happen because it's the same folks in power. And yet what we've seen is a continuation of the slow burn. And I'm convinced, Byron, that whether covert operations and financing or overt, you know, methods, that a slow burn can, we can do the next 10, 20 years in a slow burn no matter what happens with the price of oil. Again, I think that most of the listeners on this call will be much better if Armageddon should happen now than if we'd be in slow burn. But I'm not a great believer that there's going to be some catastrophic event that will clear the market and put us back in a situation where people see clearly. I think whatever we need to do, we can't wait. We need to start building arcs and not wait for the Titanic to throw us off. So whether we get thrown off the Titanic in a slow burn or in an Armageddon, it's really a matter of how many people there are to organize with. And an Armageddon, there are a lot of people to organize with, and in the slow burn, you have to do a lot more sneaking around. But I think either one are possible, and I would hate to see anybody bet the ranch on Armageddon. I like to have a life strategy, an investment strategy, where I and my family are doing well either way it goes. I don't like to bet the ranch on a strategy, and as I said before, everybody who's ever bet the ranch on Armageddon pretty much is lost.
Well, let me put it to you. This is my own question. There's one or two other questions, but many of the activists who are probably listening tonight are wondering, well, what if we somehow take down Bush? Somehow 9/11 gets exposed, and it's sort of a Watergate scenario where it's all over for the Bush administration. What is that?
So you mean George gets out of having to deal with the liabilities that he's created?
What
I think the Bushes might even finance that scenario, Byron.
Yeah, you might want to bail out anyway.
I wrote in 2000 for the New Hampshire primary. There was a group of people trying to persuade me to run for president on the Republican ticket, and I wrote an article called "Why I Declined to Run for the President of the United States."
Okay.
And what I explain in that is that basically, let's say, Byron, that we made you president tomorrow, President Bulitzer, you're the president of the United States. We've thrown out the Bushes.
Okay.
You're the president. Okay.
All right.
And you're staring at an 11 trillion dollar increase in liabilities in the last year, $4 trillion missing from the federal government,
right.
And what everybody in America wants is a check. right?
Yeah.
What everybody in America wants from you is their check. Mm. And what do you have to do to get their check? Well, you have to borrow more money from the creditors, and you have to ask Lockheed Martin and Halliburton and DynCorp and the other people who run all your information and accounting systems, and J.P. Morgan Chase who run all your bank accounts, you know, to please do such and such. Now, the reality is you have absolutely full power, and the creditors and all the people who control and run your bank accounts have all the power. They also probably have the $10 trillion that's disappeared. So they have the money, right? And what everybody wants from you is their check. So what you have to do is do whatever the creditors want you to do to get the check, right?
I think I would bail out of the White House. I'd move to New Zealand.
Well, but here's the reality. There's 73,000 neighborhoods in America, and I don't know how you'd want to count the neighborhoods in Canada and some of, because we have some Canadians listening. But say we have 100,000 neighborhoods, all told. If we're not prepared to re-engineer neighborhood by neighborhood, town by town, county by county, to start to manage our resources where we're generating more than we're using. I mean, if every year you eat more than you grow, it doesn't take long to get to a point where, you know, the storehouse is empty. So if we're not willing to change, each one of us in 100,000 neighborhoods, there's nothing that the president can do because the president's over a barrel.
I resign. We have a few more questions here, Catherine. This says, dirty tricks. Bush increases affordable homes by 40%. On September 2nd, 2004, the White House issued a press release. And the name of the press release was Increasing Affordable Housing and Expanding Home Ownership by 7 million homes over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
In parens, it says 700,000 a year added to annual U.S. new home construction of 1.8 million per year is a 39% increase in housing starts.
Right. Well, if we have a million, immigrants a year, and our home ownership rate is about 68%, then you need 700,000 new homes a year, right?
Well, there's more to this question. It says,
and if you rig it for them, they'll all vote Republican, right?
That works. It says, with the fear that the 60%+ of U.S. dollars may come back to us from overseas, do you think there is an orchestrated effort to move the U.S. dollars returning from foreign countries into the U.S. mortgage market? Would this be through Fannie Mae or Ginnie Mae? How might this work?
Well, I think the way that the $4 trillion went missing is that it financed itself. In other words, as you suck money out, you use that money to come back and finance. So I take I'm grossly oversimplifying. I take $100 million out of Treasury. I then use that money to buy Treasury securities. It puts the money back in so I can take it out again. And that's how you can steal more money in a year than you raise in taxes by running a fraudulent securities operation. So yes, I think the money comes back in to finance the bubble, and it's that bubble that creates the liquidity that allows you to pull it out. I think it's going to come back now in more insidious ways, and that is it's going to come back in the form of pools of capital specifically to buy into distressed real estate, distressed companies, to pick up equity for cheap, and most importantly, to buy into privatized assets. My sense is a lot of deals have been made before the election, so that after the election, a lot of that capital could flow back in and basically buy up privatized federal, state, and local assets. Generally, that privatization process has been slow at the municipal level. My fear is it's about to accelerate. And I think that's where there's an awful lot of opportunity for people to organize and ensure that they control those privatizations in a way that local citizens and local investors are not only protected but make money. Because we can say to that capital, hey, we're going to let you buy in as non-voting shares in our privatized corporation instead of just sitting there and saying, oh, well, we're going to sell you our land and assets. We need to, because otherwise our taxes will go up. if you look at the fundamental economics, there's a way for the local guys to organize, to control, and manage that process that both protects the resources strategically but makes the local guys money.
We just got about a minute, Catherine. We have one more question. What do you think of the bank honesty movement? I've never heard of that. Have you, the bank honesty movement?
No. I haven't heard that. I will say, I don't know what the bank honesty movement is, but I'll tell you after the call tonight, I'm going to do a Google on it. I think that there is, I'm a great believer, as you know, Byron. I have an article called Where Would Jesus Bank? And I think that diversifying the banking deposits, simply getting them decentralized, is important. But I think we need much more consumer interest and awareness about what our banks are up to. We just saw Italian prosecutors start to indict Citibank, you know, my favorite Citibank, who I like to pick on. But we're seeing many more actions. I think consumers really need to be concerned about whether or not they're banking in an institution that's clean, and they ought to start off with the premise that if you want me to bank at your bank, you've got to prove to me why you are clean. Now, how can drugs be in this neighborhood unless you're allowing it to happen? So I think we need to switch the paradigm from one of just consumer issues to one of consumer and political issues in which the bank has to prove to us that they've come clean and stayed clean. So we need consumers to start to exercise their power, because unless we clean out our financial and banking system, there is no way out.
There are a few thoughts in closing, Catherine, before we get to our prayer.
Yeah, I've said it before and I'm going to say it again. The most important choice we all have to make is, who do we want to share our life with? Who do we want to share our life with? Who do we want to have in charge of our local and municipal resources? Who do we trust with our investments? All the most important questions are who questions, and things flow from there. From now on, from here on out, whether it's our energy, whether it's our food, whether it's our water, when we purchase something, what we should ask is, who do we trust with our life? Because when you buy food, Lord knows what's in it. When you drink water, Lord knows what's in it. So we're moving from a world where we choose these things based on price or convenience to a world where we're increasingly we're going to have to make very active choices about who do we love and who do we trust and who loves and trusts us. So I say it again, the most important question you need to answer to navigate the housing bubble is the question, who do you love and who do you trust and who should love and trust you?
Well, on a note of love, we thank you, Catherine, for this two-part series on the housing bubble. And before we get to the final invocation, I just want to remind folks that, in fact, you may not even know this because we haven't sent the email out like we usually do on Wednesdays. You'll see an email about the upcoming three-part, what we're calling a mini-series, designed to introduce you to everything about precious metals, starting next week with what we're calling Precious Metals 101, to help you look at the basics of silver and gold transactions and savings, as well as introduce you to sources about these very important markets. And Catherine will bring her investment banking government experience to looking at your opportunities and risks with precious metals and alternative currencies. Also, we're going to follow that up with two more advanced precious metals seminars. We're going to look at investing in silver and gold coins with Franklin Sanders, and also finally the third part, investing in digital gold with James Turk. Both of these are experts and important leaders going against the tapeworm grain, and we look forward to seeing you on these three. You can purchase all three together or one at a time. Well, I'd like to once again bring on Eliana Obadja, our spiritual minister, to the Solari team. And Eliana, please take us out on a note of grace.
Good evening, everyone. And as you are taking in all of the blessing of having this information come in, we're just going to take a minute to reach into the realm of the spirit where, when we're connected, and all of the decisions that we're faced with, all of the opportunities that are being given, can be linked in deeply to the source of all life, which is always, always, always present. So as we look at our opportunities to organize ourselves based on the decisions that are what's in your heart, when we understand that we're reaching toward a place where we can manage things in a way that protects ourselves, and not just ourselves, but our whole community and our world, and that that can happen in a way that actually produces abundance. And that spirit is always interested in creating a win-win scenario for everyone concerned. And that as all of these opportunities come into our lives, that we can reach for the answers that are in harmony with our deepest needs, and in the recognition that we are all one. So just take a moment in the silence to actually call in for the guidance that will be able to walk you through all the things that will come up for your consideration, and to know that you are linked in with every other person on the planet. Let yourself soak in the recognition that divine help is always present to show you what is the deepest need of your heart and that of your neighbor. Find purposes to re-engineer all of our resources and to strengthen all of our relationships, that they are in harmony with the earth and with the love that is placed inside each one of us. Have a good evening. Thank you very much.
Good night, everyone.